Welcome to the Plant Pod. Grow your mind, feed your soul. I'm your host, Carly Bodrug, and the founder of the plant-based food blog, Plant You. As you probably know, if you're tuning into this podcast, I lead and advocate for a plant-based vegan lifestyle. And oftentimes what we see go along with that conversation is this talk about reducing our environmental footprint and lowering our overall waste as an individual. In today's podcast, we're going to be chatting all about how to get started in your low-waste journey, some of the biggest offenders polluting our planet, and how not to lose hope, which is a really big one because when we start talking about global warming, it can feel a little doomsday. That's why I'm super excited to welcome Lauren Ferrey, environmentalist and sustainability content creator based in California, who is a wealth of knowledge on this topic. I actually came to know her through her fantastic TikTok account, ReLauren, where she shares her low-waste message to over 123,000 followers at the time of recording this. Before we get started, I just want to say a big thank you for listening. If you enjoy this show, take a screenshot and post it in your stories with anything interesting that you learned, tagging me at PlantU and Lauren at re.laurenferrey on Instagram. I'll link her account in the show notes. As well, since this is a new podcast, your five-star reviews literally mean the world to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And without further ado, welcome Lauren to the Plant Pod.
I'm so psyched to be here. I'm psyched that you're doing this. The world needs this. This is awesome.
So you run this absolutely incredible TikTok account where every day you're posting these videos advocating for a low-waste lifestyle, holding these huge corporations accountable for their waste. And I'm so interested because you've obviously dedicated your life to this. How did your whole sustainability journey get started?
My mom is a first-generation American. Her folks are from Argentina. And I say that because I was really lucky I got to go to Argentina before the pandemic in February of last year. And I saw so many sustainability practices in my family's home there and just like in the community in general. And so I think my mom being raised with a lot of those principles, it was almost like second nature. I think that shows up for a lot of South American families too. Like we reuse everything. You would never throw away something after one use. Being very connected to our food. Things that I'm learning now are like very sustainable by nature. We're generative by nature. So my mom is a single mom. She raised my sisters and I have two sisters with definite like sustainable practices in the home. And then in full transparency, it was our presidential election of 2016, when I think a lot of folks were like, whoa, I didn't realize how much I cared about something until it was being threatened to be taken away. And so as someone who grew up by the beach, I'm from LA, offshore drilling was like the topic that the straw that broke the camel's back for me. And I plugged into an environmental NGO local in LA called the Surfrider Foundation. And they're an amazing environmental NGO that was really vocal against offshore drilling across the whole country. And then from there, like found community and was like, wow, look at all of these amazing climate activists who are so passionate and are so knowledgeable. And so that was four and a half years ago. And I feel like I'm addicted to the movement. I'm like so inspired and in awe of the people who are leading the movement. And, I tell people this, I'm like, oh, wow, this is what like a life's purpose feels like when you're like, oh, I can't imagine doing anything else. Like what I read, what I watch, what I talk about, what I'm passionate about, what I will work towards for the rest of my life is fighting emissions. You know, it's like, oh, to make a more equitable future for my future children and grandchildren.
So if someone is listening and they've never really considered their environmental footprint on our world, what's your biggest piece of advice as a place to start?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. Like if someone wants to know their footprint is to like first start asking questions. And I'm learning that those are like my first two pieces of advice for folks who want to learn more is like start asking questions. And then start talking about it. And before we talk about like reducing our emissions or eating plant-based or any of that, like after or before we execute something, let's just be super curious and start asking questions and be like, what is a food desert? Like, how do people not have access to fruits to some fruits and vegetables? Or like, what is a carbon emission or greenhouse gas emission? And what does that look like when humans are inhaling that? And you can start, and you just can like keep going and going and going. So my first piece of advice would be start asking questions. And I think having like a never-ending curiosity in this is so crucial, because like things are changing every day. Like look at what's happening in Texas right now, or like in seven states that are in like extreme weather conditions that are directly correlated with the climate crisis. We're like, oh, this is what it looks like. Why do we have, how can we have snowstorms if the earth is heating up? If it's global warming, how do we have snowstorms? And start asking questions. And how is weather and climate related? And yeah, start asking questions. Cause I know for me, I was like, wait, are we offshore drilling elsewhere? Or like, what happens if we put an oil rig off the coast of LA? And what are these big fossil fuel companies looking for that they don't have elsewhere? And what do these pipelines mean? And just like super curious and all of that. And then secondly, starting to talk about it. One of my favorite TED Talks of all time is by a climate scientist, and her name's Catherine Hayhoe. And she says, we don't need more science or data. Like people have been sharing the science and the data for since the 60s, and it isn't changing minds. But what will be are the anecdotal personal connections with the environment and with people, and people passionately telling those stories. That's what will change hearts and minds, hopefully. And so for me, instead of being like, the climate is heating up at this rate, and like, we're losing this permafrost, and the oceans are rising, and the oceans are warming, and all these things, I'm like, as someone who feels so spiritually connected with the environment, and I literally feel like heaven on earth is on a surfboard in the water at sunset, I'm like, wow, this is what I feel like heaven. I wish everyone could experience this. And how that, like that moment is under such extreme risk and extreme threat. I'm like, oh, and that's what I'm protecting, is this beautiful part of our universe that so many people feel so connected to, protecting that.
With all these massive weather events happening, with the offshore drilling, do you ever lose a bit of hope in the future of our Earth?
Yeah, it's the term is called eco-anxiety now. There's actually okay. a whole study on it. They even coined the term eco-anxiety. And Catherine Kellogg, I'm sure you follow her too. She's at Going Zero Waste. Her and I have become friends, just like you and I will now, like fellow creators online. And we had a call yesterday. We talked about how it's probably like one of the number one questions that pops up in our DMs now from people in the community. Like, how do you deal with it? How it can feel so overwhelming. And like, are we doomed? And what's the point, you know? And something I think that gives me hope is like the optimism, or are the optimists. And there's a podcast called How to Save a Planet with Dr. Ayanna Johnson and Alex Bloomberg. It's on Spotify. And at the end of every interview, they interview like the climate scientists and climate advisors of the White House and different researchers and everyone. And the last question they ask everyone is, how screwed are we? And the optimism, like you would think people would be like, we're doomed. It's like, it's game over. We just have to prepare for a heating world and people are going to start dying by the tens of millions. And almost everyone, I guess almost every episode I've listened to, gives such a wonderful optimistic perspective that's like, it's not too late. And we have the tools and resources and solutions we need. We just have to implement them. And so I think the optimism is what gives me hope. And I guess how I cope with the loss of hope is like taking a break. Cause as with any topic, you can start doom scrolling and you can start just going down these deep rabbit holes, and social media will continue to feed all of that to you if you're looking for that. Taking a break, turning off the phone, going outside, like whatever it is, how we connect with nature most. Some people that might be going outside, some people that might be like connecting with other people because we are part of nature. So maybe it's like having a cup of coffee on the couch with your mom or with your partner or whoever. But yeah, I guess that's what gives me hope and then how I deal with the eco anxiety.
As someone who is plant-based, my understanding of climate change and impact on the environment is often very limited to kind of the vegan movement and the impact that animal agriculture has on our planet. I'm curious, from your perspective, being much more educated in this, what are the biggest drivers that are warming up our planet and driving it to this crisis mode?
So there's a really awesome resource that I turn to quite a bit when trying to understand the solutions for the climate crisis, and it's called Project Drawdown. And it was authored by 120 plus climate scientists, along with Paul Hawken, who essentially like curated all of these solutions. And so while we can look at like, what are the biggest drivers? What are the things that are the biggest polluters? And a quick aside, I think something that folks don't talk about enough is there are 100 companies who are responsible for 71% of global emissions. And so while individuals, we want to focus on our own individual action, and those big polluting companies like want individuals to focus on their own action because it only makes up 29%, right? So first and foremost, the biggest, 71% of the biggest drivers are 100 corporations, and they need to be held accountable. Like at the end of the day, you're polluting the planet. You're making it unsafe for current and future generations. You need to be restricted, regulated, and incentivized to change, you know? So that first and foremost, but with Drawdown, it's the most comprehensive plan with like the top 100 solutions to combat the climate crisis. And you'll be stoked to know that number two or three is eating a plant-rich diet. And when you look at animal agriculture and how much energy it takes, energy, land, water, time to farm animals compared to farming plants to feed, like we're growing plants to feed animals when we could just grow plants to feed humans, you know? So I turn to draw down quite a bit on the top solutions. The first one would like confuse us. It confuses everyone. It's about refrigerants. And that shows up in like our refrigerators and our ACs, which makes sense. As the planet continues to heat, we're going to need more like AC units, which is insane. And the like chemicals that make up the refrigerants in those units are like terrible for the planet, but we're only going to continue to increase the manufacturing of them and the usage of them. And they're extremely toxic. You can't just like put them in a landfill. So that's the one that like freaks everybody out. You're like, wait, what? Why aren't we talking about that? And then I don't know exactly the numbers, but number two is eating plant-based diet. Number three is reducing our food waste. Like how can we have a hunger issue when 40% of the food in the US goes uneaten? You know, it's crazy. So there's big drivers. There's also ones that's like that are very like social sustainable focus, like educating women and children, I believe is number four or five. And women in some countries don't go to, or girls don't go to school when they're on their period and they start missing school and, or just aren't even allowed to go to school. And what that does to the workforce and the community and having children very young. And yeah, there's a lot to learn in Project Drawdown as far as solutions go.
I want to circle back something you said about 70% of emissions created by 100 companies. Was that correct? Mm-hmm. Do you find as a content creator in your space that a lot of pressure comes down on you and other eco warriors, for lack of a better term, even though in reality it's these companies that are creating the majority of emissions?
Totally. So I think there's so much pressure and focus on individual action. And there is a wonderful PSA. I'll share it with you. I don't know if it's quite a PSA. It was played during the election and it was like a narrative piece where it's all these big oil executives and one is like hitting golf balls in his backyard. And another one is like having a whiskey in his house. And another one is like sitting near his fireplace. And they're just saying like, we here at Big Oil, we know that the climate is changing, but we're paying a lot of money to make sure that you don't know about that. Or like that we're not regulated for that. I'll send you the video. And it's like, we paid researchers a lot of money to find out how detrimental our operations were. And we also paid a lot of money to make sure no one found out about it. And they're like burning the evidence. And then the one that just like gets under your skin, it's like, we know that emissions are causing global warming or causing climate change, but you should really start a compost pile. And just the like push, or it's probably time that you start recycling. And I'm like, oh my gosh, isn't that exactly what they want us to think, that it's up to us, you know?
So what do you do in that circumstance though? I mean, I'm still inclined to recycle, still inclined to eat plant-based, because I feel like as a human on this planet who's conserving energy and contributing no matter what an environmental footprint, I guess the pressure needs to be really pushed on these corporations.
Boom. You got it. Catherine says, to bring her up again, Catherine says, individuals must act so government and corporations can react. And it's so true. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning. Like, number one, start asking questions and talk about it, because that generates awareness in our own lives. And we have to be aware of these things. Like, individual action also includes being aware. Like, that is individual action. Voting is individual action. And so everyone, like, I think, pushes off individual action. But could you imagine not recycling? Would you ever be the person that like put recyclables in the garbage? No way.
The guilt I would feel, right?
So not even guilt, but if it's like you're given two options. So
100%. Yeah.
Yes. I think where it gets troublesome is when we put so much pressure on ourselves. And that kind of goes with like the eco anxiety too, of like, and the gatekeeping in the movement and the harsh like criticism and expectations from the community sometimes. Like, I can't believe, Lauren, you drink from a disposable coffee cup. I'm like, oh my gosh. Hello everyone, I'm human. Nice to meet you too. and then I remember, I'm like, wow, that's exactly what those corporations want me to feel right now. They want me to feel bad for using plastic, which is the very material that they've made.
I started watching this documentary the other day, and it's reminding me of our conversations. It was about corporations and how corporations take on the attributes of like a psychopath, and they become basically like a human entity. So when we refer to corporations, I guess one of the problem is who are you actually talking to?
Right.
Right. Like how do you move that needle when it's become like an entity of its own?
Yeah. Well, something I always have to remember, and maybe this goes back because I worked at like a massive CPG for 7 years, and like corporations are made up out of people. Like sometimes we forget that. I'm like, wait, individual action can also start internally in a corporation when people have courage and boldness to speak up and be like, hey, CEO at the town hall, or like, hey, CMO, hey, COO, we need to do the right thing or I'm leaving. and I will be very vocal and clear about why I'm leaving. Change or you lose your employee base. And I guess the game that corporations are in, if not like a sustainable or regenerative, equitable, ethical corporation, it is the bottom line. And so I think it can be dangerous when corporations start greenwashing and they're just saying things to like sell additional products. And we're seeing that with like, especially in the fast fashion industry, they're like, we have a sustainable line, we have a sustainable collection. It's like, it doesn't work if you only offer part of your inventory, right? This needs to be like a full supply chain change, like supply chain evolution of your supply chain and manufacturing and employee compensation and workers' rights and everything. But if once it starts affecting their bottom line and folks will start choosing an alternative is when they're most impacted. So we vote, like, I think voting with our dollar is how we do that too, like what that looks like. So yes, we can speak up to corporations and also just choose not to support them anymore. Like, we get to vote with our dollar.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're seeing a lot of dairy companies go bankrupt right now because people are choosing plant milks, whether they're vegan or not. I guess that is picking industry and a more sustainable one, we hope. I'm interested in kind of the clothing part, and I don't know how much you know about sustainability when as it comes to clothing, because this is something I struggle with as well. What do you look for, and how do you practice creating a more sustainable closet?
I think for anyone getting started, watching the film The True Cost is just like, I don't know if you've seen it before.
I have. It's so good.
And I don't think there's anything else like it yet. I think, like, and you're probably familiar with a lot of the food documentaries, and like, there's anything, if anything within the plant-based or vegan community, there's a documentary on. If you want to learn about how you can be vegan and athletic, you can watch Game Changers. If you want to learn about how animals are treated in animal agriculture, there's like several documentaries about that, or about your health, or about like the pharmaceutical companies, right? There's a film for everything. And I think The True Cost is kind of like the holy grail for the fast fashion industry, and just exposing a lot of the malpractices and like modern day slavery that are happening in those massive garment factories. So I would start there. I would start watching The True Cost. I guess something I've always done, and this probably goes back to how my mom raised us, is like, we've always shopped secondhand. Always. Like, everything this was gifted, but then my shirt and my pants and my necklace are all secondhand, and my socks are secondhand. So I think when you go into a thrift shop or you go online at Poshmark or whatever, ThredUp, and you see how much inventory there already is, you're like, why would I ever need to buy something new when there is so much used inventory already? Like, do we need new things when like perfectly fine, barely secondhand used things are available? So that's always been my encouragement, and my rule of thumb is like choosing secondhand. And there are amazing sites like Depop and Poshmark and ThredUp that, if you don't like the smell of a thrift store, or like maybe you don't have good options or shops in your neighborhood, then those are great tools to use too. However, there are really awesome sustainable clothing brands that are popping up. And I think the best ones are like sometimes the smallest ones, because they're like hyper aware and transparent about their supply chain. And the one I always talk about is called 4Days. I don't know if you've heard of them.
I haven't. I'll have to look it up after.
They're awesome. They're definitely like basic pieces, but that's, I guess, how I typically dress most of the time anyways. But they'll take back your old clothes. So like, wow. It's from them, but they're a true closed loop system. And they're super transparent about their supply chain, and everything is like small batch made with organic cotton. They're wonderful. They're a wonderful company. And then they'll take back your old clothes, and you get to buy your next piece at a discounted price because it's technically a swap. And it's awesome. It's like so rad to see what they're doing. And then there's also amazing ones like Organic Basics, for example. They do like undergarments. And they are practicing like regenerative agriculture on their cotton farms. And they use organic cotton to make their products. And then you start getting into like, how is our cotton harvested on we're wearing on our clothes on our body? And again, like starting to ask all those questions, like, I didn't even think about that. Like, of course, cotton is something that is harvested from the ground. And are we taking care of the soil? And if not, what is the alternative? And why would I ever choose something that like wasn't made from organic cotton, you know?
So I guess going back to what you were talking about before, it's more about supporting the companies who are doing the right thing, and then hoping the larger companies will also follow suit and take notice about the sustainability practices that people have interest in that will hopefully ignite change across the world.
Yeah, boom. You got it. And like hitting them where it hurts. Because even yesterday I posted a video where I, you know, La Colombe coffee. Do you have that up in Canada?
I don't think we have it in Canada.
Okay. It's just like it's a coffee shop. I've been to the one in New York. I think it started on the East Coast. And they do like draft oat milk lattes. And you can get it like in the shop in a glass and it feels like a beer. You're like getting a beer. It was awesome. And I had it obviously pre-COVID. But my sister had the one with the can or the can and it has like a plastic lip on it. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like you can buy coffee without a plastic lip. Why would they need to put that on? And I've reached out on their email. And I guess as now like a creator with a little bit of a following or with like a community online, I made a quick TikTok about it. That was like, what the heck is up with this plastic? And it wasn't aggressive or like, I don't think it was too confrontational by any means, but was like, do you actually need this? Because we have terrible plastic recycling infrastructure in the States. We both know it's going right to a landfill. Other coffee cans don't have it. Do you need this? And sure enough, I got an email this morning from La Colombe that was like, let's chat. I'm like, okay. So like, because however many people saw it on TikTok, I'm like, okay, who knows? Who knows how this call will work? But I'm like, you have to change or people are not, why would you buy one with plastic if their competition exists without it, you know?
I saw something really cool from you a little while back. I think you were doing templates for people to email to companies when they see their plastic waste. I don't know if you sent one to Starbucks. Can you jog my memory about this?
Yeah. I, again, as like an ocean enthusiast and someone who lives near the beach, I pick up trash at the beach all the time. And you don't have to live near the beach or near the ocean to do that. You can do like urban cleanups wherever you are because there's trash everywhere. And if it's near a drain, it's probably going to get into a waterway in some way, shape or form, and all water leads to the ocean. So anyways, I was picking up trash and I was like, wait, these are all brands that are like clearly identified on this trash. Like we all know that green straws come from Starbucks and we all know that like, whatever it was, the pretzels company and, a Clif Bar company or whatever. And even someone like Cliff, it's like, I love the organization and they actually do quite a bit with sustainability. And I've listened to like podcasts and videos from their founder and I think have the right motive, but still offer their product in single use plastic. And so I just wrote to them, like, actually, Catherine, I feel like I'm name dropping her so much, but she has a wonderful blog post and I can share the link with you. And she has like a formula that she uses too. And it's like, always acknowledge them first of like, what do you like about them? And then let them know, I think she says like, let them know that they would be in good company if they switched, if they changed. And like, it's only in their best interest to change. And then make the ask very clear, like, what are you asking for? So like Starbucks, paper straws exist everywhere. Or do a take back program or something, but you have to be held accountable and responsible for all of this trash that is showing up on our beaches. And then be persistent. And then I guess if necessary, use public outcry. So be like, I don't know, you see amazing petitions come from like elementary schools and middle schools. They're like, we got 500 signatures to get plastic out of our cafeteria, whatever, out of our vending machines. And it works, you know?
Do you think that a lot of companies shifting to non-plastic straws was more of a kind of marketing campaign than an actual movement to be more sustainable? Because I always laugh when I get a drink out, and especially during COVID times, you can't necessarily bring a reusable. And they give me a paper straw and a plastic cup. And it's like, were you even thinking this through?
Right. I think, well, the whole thing about straws is that they jam recycling bins or recycling like machines.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought it was about the turtles.
Turtles too. Right. I mean, if we're going to say that like all plastic goes to the ocean, I don't know what Canada's in recycling results are like, but ours, as far as plastic goes, ours in the States is like embarrassing for how much plastic we use and how
terrible. I think we're pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, it's also like the plastic manufacturers know full well that it's not going to get recycled unless it has like a 1 or a 5 on it. Again, this is what I've learned. PLA number 1 or PET 1 or 5 are actually like out of the 9% probability that it gets recycled. Those are the two that are like most likely to get recycled. Everything else, like the plastic films, the thin ones, are just like, shouldn't even be put in the recycling bins, or like the bubble mailers from Amazon or whatever, like shouldn't even be put near recycling because they only jam up the recycling machines. And so I think a lot of the attention that straws got, someone explained to me one time that a recycling tumbler looks like the inside of a dryer and it has a bunch of holes, like the recycling tumbler. And so the straws jam up the holes and cannot be recycled. And yes, everyone saw that turtle video of like the straw being pulled from the turtle's nose. And I think everyone was like, I'm never using a straw again. But you're right. You're totally right. Like you get a cup and a lid with a paper straw and you're like, what? Like even like the weight or the ratio of plastic cup to straw, you're like, I would almost rather take a paper cup, a paper lid, and a plastic straw at that point. So yeah, probably, yes, 1000%. Part of it is greenwashing. And then something to be cognizant of is 40% of the marine debris that's floating in the oceans is from commercial fishing nets. And it's something that like nobody is talking about. And actually, I will say this like fully transparent. When I first became plant-based, I would make an exception occasionally for fish, being like, oh, I'm plant-based, but eat fish occasionally. One, because I like live so close to those. I was like, oh, that's where it's coming from. I don't feel like landlocked and like questioning where my fish comes from. But then secondly, I don't know, maybe it was a social thing. Maybe it was like a rebel thing. I don't know. And then after participating in a few like big commercial fishing net cleanup projects, I was like, oh my God, who am I kidding? Like this is, here I am picking up straws and chip wrappers on the beach. And like, this is what's out there.
Yeah. One of the most horrific things I've ever learned about, I took a environmental and plant-based course through eCornell, and they talked about, I'm going to say it wrong, but I think it was ground fishing. But basically what happens is these big ships go out to catch whatever fish, like a common one that people eat, and they drag the sea's bottom floor, bring it all up. So everything off the bottom of crabs, fish, sometimes dolphins, and basically kill them and then take the fish that people eat, keep it, and then throw everything back in the water. And that was just horrific to me because I'm like, people think they're making the sustainable choice by eating just a cut of fish once a week or something. Meanwhile, they don't know the massive impact that is having on our seabeds and every single other fish that is in the ocean. It was just so shocking to me that I had never learned about it before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know what that's called? Bottom fishing or something, or bottom grilling?
No, they, oh
my God. It's like a rake, like with your hands. Yes. They rake the floor. It's horrible.
Bottom troughing. But bycatch, what you're talking to is bycatch.
So, yes.
So I think it's probably more now. Actually, I don't know. With overfishing, who knows? It's probably way more. But I learned like a statistic in a marine bio class one time that said 30% of the fish we catch on, or of fisher folks catch on board, 30% isn't what they're looking for. And by the time they sort everything on deck and push it over, it is like long dead. So we are just like, yeah, catching 30, just killing 30% by accident, you know, by error, and then just throwing it overboard.
Just horrible.
I don't think it's called bottom trough, something like that. Exactly.
Bottom trawling, I think. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes for anyone listening because it's worth looking into. It's just, I had no idea, even though I'm in the plant-based space, what it was. And the whole concept of it was just horrific. And then I think fish are often peddled to people as the sustainable, healthy choice, but it's honestly one of the worst for our oceans, especially the pollution of the fishing gear and everything. I try to drive that home, but everyone I know usually keeps fish in their first year. So because you do look at it as the more sustainable choice, it's not beef and cows getting killed. And I think people see fish differently than an animal, but anyways, right. It's not great.
Right. Because it's not a mammal. It makes it like less. Right. There's an amazing film by Patagonia called Artificial, and it's mostly about salmon fishing and like all the hatcheries and what they're doing with dams. And I think most of it is shot up in the Northwest, and even like integrates the indigenous community and what we've done to indigenous land and their rivers and manipulating it, things like dams. But they like went undercover and showed you what a salmon fish farm looks like. Cause I think how people combat that is like, oh, I'll just eat farmed fish, because then it's not caught out at sea and it's not ruining the ocean's populations and it's farmed, things like that. And then they show you what some of these farmed salmon look like. And you're like, that is an alien. Like, who would eat that?
I've never seen it. Now I'm going to have to look it up. It sounds scary.
Artificial. It's really good.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is on TikTok, viewers or followers are mostly way younger than the demographic we see on Instagram. And sometimes I'm like, wow, this generation is interesting. But on the other hand, I'm very encouraged to see their engagement in environmental issues and wanting to change the world. Do you notice that same kind of trend?
1,000%. And I will say it. I don't know how old you are, but I'm 28. I turned 29 on Saturday.
I'm 28 too.
Okay. Amazing. A nice, strong millennial. I'm like a bona fide millennial. And so I would like almost be embarrassed to tell my 28-year-old friends that I was on TikTok, because it was seen as this thing where like teenagers were on here and were dancing. And while there is plenty of that on there, there's also amazing, like multi-generational creators now. Like some of the like grandparents of TikTok are my favorite creators. Or, oh my goodness, one I found the other day was, I think she's a teenager and she's documenting her grandmother's Alzheimer's, but in the most beautiful way, and is like telling her stories to jog her memory, and it's acknowledging her and it's telling her grandmother how many followers she has and how people love to hear her stories, and it's so beautiful. Anyways, so while there are lots of, I mean, the predominant population of users on TikTok is Gen Z, but I am so, just like you said, I am so moved and inspired and in awe of their desire to make a difference. And I think that's even what the like generational scientists, whoever like studies generational characteristics, are saying about this generation, is they all have this. They all want to make a difference. Cause I even think someone called it like the Greta effect. But they're like, you could pick anything. Like you could pick anything to be passionate about and be like, I want to fix this problem, because the world is not short of any problems these days. I don't know if it ever has been, but anyways, they feel called and inspired to do something about it. And a quick story about that. I got to speak at like a virtual high school conference a few weeks ago, and their knowledge on the subject as like 16, 17 year olds like surpasses my own. And granted, I've only been in this space for like 5 years, actually learning and engaging and participating in the movement. But I was like sharing nothing that they didn't already know, you know? And I'm like, oh my goodness, what I would have done to have your wisdom at that age. And we saw it a lot in the States before the election. You had so many teenagers who were more excited to vote than anything else, like more excited to vote than drive, or like more excited to vote than turn 21 to like have a beer. Like they could not wait to turn 18 to vote, and were almost like angry that they couldn't participate in this election. And that type of like civil engagement and desire to make a difference and use their voice for good is so inspiring.
I love it. I've noticed a lot of engagement in the environmental movement by that generation. And it does, when you start to lose hope, that does give you hope, because those people are going to be the movers and shakers when we need it most, I think, and I hope. I read that you wrote an article for the New York Times about giving up your car, which, living in rural Canada, I can't even fathom. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was like and why you decided to do it?
Yeah. I want to be extremely mindful how I share this story too, because the more I like go back to it, the more I like cringe at the things I said. And I want to preface by acknowledging that like, I'm not an anomaly by any means. I think some folks hear, oh, you don't have a car in LA. That must be impossible. It's not like we have the public transportation infrastructure of like New York or another major city in the States. And so I'm not an anomaly by any means. This is just my own story. And I had the opportunity to get to share it with the New York Times as part of their I Quit series. So it's not like they did a full expose on like environmentalists who gave up certain things in their lives. It was, the series was I Quit fill in the blank. So people quit sex, people quit tobacco, people quit the priesthood, people quit smoking, like people quit all of these things. And they just did like, I think it was like 12 or 13 parts. And I said, I quit cars. So that was my story. So I also think it's worth noting, LA was designed by the car companies, by like the car and gas companies, which I didn't know this. And so if you look at the map of LA, you're like, what? Like, that's why it's so massive, because everything is so far from each other. Like our port versus our downtown versus Santa Monica and like our Ferris wheel and just like a nice outdoor area versus Dodger Stadium versus like everything is so far from each other. And I remember learning about that in school, that like the big car companies were like, let's put Dodger Stadium here and let's put the Coliseum here and let's put the Rose Bowl here, whatever, to make everything so far. So you had to drive. So I think LA gets this reputation that you have to have a car to get around, and it's not true. And I also lived like walking, biking distance from my office. So I was very fortunate in that space, because I know a lot of people in LA have like an hour minimum commute with traffic. So I started plugging into the environmental movement quite a bit, and I hated that I had this gas car, and I had just bought it because my previous job gave me like a company car. So I had to buy my own car. And even though it was like a fuel efficient little Chevy Sonic or something, I hated putting gas in it. And I was like, I can't believe I'm doing this. So I think it was in 2017, every month for the year, I like tried to give up something for a month. And in May, I gave up my car for a month and literally like locked my keys in my roommate's and like her box and was like, do not let me touch this. And if I needed a car, I wanted to borrow one from a friend or a family member or something, so I could know if I didn't have a car, I would still have someone in my community who would let me borrow it. And so I went a month without it. I'm also very lucky in Southern California that we have weather that allows you to like ride your bike and walk outside and take advantage of things like that. So anyways, I went a month without it. And then I was like, I'm going to do it. Like, I'm going to sell the car. And I mean, yeah, I sold the car and was also paying off my student loans at the time too. And I think I estimated that the car was costing anywhere from like $5,000 to $6,000 a year, from the payment to the gas to insurance, everything. So with that like $6,000 over the course of a few years, I got to pay off my student loan, which was pretty epic. And then, yeah, now I just don't have a car. And now I live down in Orange County, which is even like less car friendly than LA. And yeah, or what I would say, less car friendly. Like, you have to have a car in Orange County, so they say. But it's been fun. I wouldn't say I don't have a car. I just say I share a car with my fiance, or like we're a single car household, which is very true for a lot of families in the States. So I'm not an anomaly by any means, but
I think it's a really interesting story though, because it draws attention to the fact that we probably don't need half the stuff we have, and we spend money on a lot of things we don't need. Did you kind of learn that from that process?
100%. And there's awesome like new technologies that exist where you can essentially rent your neighbor's car by the hour. It's called Get Around. I think they're going to like go national anytime soon. But it was wonderful. And it shows how we can have like few things in a community, which is probably how like the initial communities were built. Like you wouldn't have like 50 horses or something for a community. You would probably have like one that the community would use if they needed it. So I think that's, yeah, it shows up the same way for anything. Or think of like a lawnmower or think of something that you're like, this is so expensive and it takes up so much space. Or like a vacuum. I'm looking at my vacuum right now. I'm like, do we all need a vacuum? Or could there be one for like 10 households on our street and we all just shared it? But we're so insulated and separated and like don't like talking to each other anymore, you know, that would like freak people out.
Oh my goodness, that's such a communal perspective. And I feel like it could solve so many of our issues, even financially. I mean, the amount of stuff I buy, especially in Canada, like we have such a short summer season and we buy so much stuff to deal with the summer and the winter. You use it like 3 times. It would be so great to like just go, just pitch and share.
Yeah.
Would you consider yourself a minimalist at this point?
I was talking to a girlfriend about it yesterday, and I think I have like minimalist characteristics about myself. Like I own fewer nicer things, I guess, instead of having like a crap ton of crap. I really like to reuse things over and over and over again. Always trying to see, and I get that from my mom, like always trying to see a second life in things. But I think that's where the two movements kind of clash at times, because you might open like a minimalist cabinet and see like 2 Tupperwares, right? And they're like, oh, these are the 2 Tupperwares I use. And I just use this because this is like very real for us and in my mom's house. And then you open my mom, who's like an amazing activist, like full climate feminist. And you open her Tupperware cabinet and it's like anything that came in single use plastic or a jar, even her like to go from takeout, is like cleaned out and is in the cabinet. So you open it and it just looks like it's a bunch of garbage, but she reuses everything. And so while that might not be like a minimalist, she's like, I'm not going to create trash. Like this isn't trash if I can reuse it again. So I think I share characteristics of both things. Like I do believe in having fewer better things. But I also like to reuse things as much as I can. Yeah.
I love that. There's one more thing I want to touch on, and it's just out of interest. I read a stat maybe a year ago that really shocked me, and it's that period pads take like something like 600 years to break down. And I'm like, oh my goodness, the amount of those a woman generally uses in their lifetime. And it's never something I've put a second thought to. Do you think there is, I know we've got like the Diva Cup now and some other options. Do you think the period world is shifting to a more sustainability?
Yeah, totally. It is crazy if you think about it's like 52% of the folks in the States. And I guess I keep talking about this from a state's perspective, but
most of my following's from the States. So okay, most cool. Of the listeners will be from there.
Okay. So 52% of the folks in the States have a period or will have a period. And then you're like, wait, and you get a period once a month. And you use disposable products. Let's say you use like, I don't know, 10 to 15 in 4 to 5 days, right? Like, oh my goodness, do that math. And that is so much trash in a year. And then multiply it by like since the invention of the pad, right? Yes, there are like the menstrual cups, which some folks might like really not get behind, and I don't blame them. Like it is a funky product to just like go for. Like it definitely has like a learning curve. I say that in one side of my mouth, and the other side of my mouth I'm like, it is probably my favorite sustainable product that I have. And actually it's like connected me so much with my body and my cycle and my rhythm in like such a beautiful way. And oddly enough, I feel like it's made me a stronger feminist, like being really connected to my cycle, because it's something that maybe we've been told so much to be like disgusted and disconnected and like, don't look at it and it's gross. And everyone wants us to think that it's this like gross, dirty thing. And since using a menstrual cup, I feel like very connected to it. And I like talk to all my friends and family about it. And I'm like, wow, this is my body's like natural flow. And it's actually like very cool. It's like very inspiring, very cool. And I feel very connected. So yeah, there are that. There's also like, if a cup isn't for you, there's like organic cotton tampons. There's She Thinks underwear. And I think you're just like period underwear you can look at. When it's essentially just like a pad built into underwear and then you wash it just like you would your normal underwear. So there's lots of self-sustainable alternatives that create low waste or no waste when you're on your period. I think it's definitely worth checking out.
You mentioned how a period cup is one of your favorite low waste or zero waste items. Is there other things in your household that are real game changers that you can put our followers onto, including myself?
Yes. I'm like not paid to say this, but I think it's like so rad. And I bought, actually, this is cool because it all comes full circle. I bought this thing called the leaf razor like 3 years ago, 2 years ago, three now. Wow. And loved it so much because a safety razor is typically like an old school barber tool that you've probably seen. It's like a rod like this, and then it has a blade on top where both ends are exposed and the head doesn't move. And it was for like barbers who would shave beards, right? But this leaf razor is like a metal rod and it had a pivoting head. So it like replicates that of a normal razor you would buy from like the pharmacy or whatever. And you could put in these single blades or whatever, the safety blades. And it had a pivoting head. And I was like, this thing is amazing. And it's honestly like so awesome. Cause I think sometimes we try a new sustainable product and we're like, for me at least, I'd be like, I'll make it work. Like it might not be my favorite, but I'll make it work. And if I'm not using plastic, like it's okay. Like I'll make it work. But the leaf razor, I was like, this thing is epic. And it replicates the same feeling of a plastic razor, but I create zero trash. And then I like went ahead and made one of my first TikToks about it and was like, look at this razor and stop buying blades. And like to date, that is my TikTok that has the most views. And I think a lot of people were just as psyched about it as me, like, what is this thing? So I do love my leaf razor. I also love the organization. Like the founder is wonderful and their commitment to reducing waste and being extremely inclusive because everybody shaves. Well, I shouldn't say that. A lot of people shave, you know? So just being an extremely inclusive brand and product is awesome. But something that I think you'll appreciate, Carly, is I love my Instapot. Like I love my Instapot. And I think it's not a typical thing you would think of like sustainability related because it's just like a kitchen appliance. But buying bulk is like huge by trying to avoid waste or living low waste. Buying bulk, it's way more affordable too. And so I buy my beans bulk for like nothing, like 59 cents a pound or something crazy, 79 cents a pound. And so I can make like pots of beans, garbanzo beans, black beans, chickpea, whatever, red beans, northern beans, by like for nothing, for like 79 cents. And I'll put the like vegan bouillon in it or whatever. And we do it with rice and I feel like we're always using the Instapot and we do a lot of meal prepping in this house. My fiance eats like a 12-year-old boy, just like so much food. So I love my Instapot too. I think for folks who want to reduce their plastic and buy bulk and want to eat plant-based, it is like, and it's so effortless. You literally just like press a button and it's ready. So
yeah, I'm a big fan, especially for things like rice and beans. It's just fantastic. And you're right. That allows you to buy in bulk, reduce your plastic, eat it less probably because you're meal prepping. So good all around. I love it. The last question, I swear, is I heard you do a TikTok where you said you were leaving the term zero waste behind in 2020. What drove that decision and what do you use now instead?
I think I realized, and I am guilty of this too, but I realized there was some gatekeeping going on within the sustainability movement. And you probably feel like it in the vegan movement too. It's like,
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And how like dangerous is that? And I keep thinking about like these big oil and gas companies just like sitting back and watching us go at each other, like, but you use plastic and you drive a car, or like you drank milk, or I saw you eat ice cream or whatever, just like go at each other, or like you went to McDonald's or whatever, go at each other. And I'm like, isn't that what these big companies want us to do? They're just watching and they're like, yes, keep fighting. Like, yes. So I'm guilty of that too. Like I remember even something as silly as taking an online workout class, and one of the instructors like took a sip from a water bottle. And I think I even wrote in like the IG live, like, girl, we got to get you a reusable water bottle or something like that. And there's ways to encourage and invite people into like the space, whatever. But I just realized how much gatekeeping was going on. And I was like, oh no, like my goal for 2021 is to make this so inclusive, where it's like, you don't have to have a degree and you don't have to be a vegan and you can drive a car and like all of these things, and you can use plastic and you can do these things and still be on this train, because it will not be a handful of people who do this. It has to be the masses who are educated and inspired and feel welcomed and like they're part of it. And that goes back to like that awareness piece we talked about earlier. So I remember I used to say zero waste, and especially as a creator now too, I would even like use the hashtag, or I would use it in voiceovers or things like that. And I wasn't being real with my community, because I was like very much so creating waste. Like I have a trash can and I have a recycling bin, and I'm like, these are the things that my community isn't seeing. And it's not being zero waste. If you have a trash can, like, we're not being zero waste if we have a trash can, because we are creating waste. And so while I do try to curb my waste generation by doing things like composting and recycling and reusing as much as I can, I still very much so create waste. It's just low waste. It's not zero waste, or like, I'm not zero waste. I'm like as low waste as possible. So I hope with the intention in that other people feel like they're invited and welcomed into this space. And like, there is no such thing as perfect sustainability. And Megan McSherry, she runs the Activism account. She's wonderful. And she's always saying progress over perfection. And I think it's so important. And I'm sure that shows up for you in your space too. People are like, I want to be vegan, but, and you're like, you're doing the best with what you can, where you have, and that's what matters.
I think that's a perfect way to wrap this up. And I'm so glad we talked, because I often feel very kind of doomsday about these topics, and you're just so inspiring and a bright light, and you have such a sense of optimism that I think will really carry through to our listeners. So thank you so much for coming on the Plant Pod. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that is it for this week's episode of the Plant Pod. I hope you took away some nuggets of wisdom like I did. If you have any guest requests or really liked this episode, feel free to DM me on Instagram. I try to reply to all my direct messages, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you really enjoyed it, remember to take a screenshot and share what you learned in your stories, and make sure to tag me so that I can share it. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.